I think on the straight and normal road of leaving the crisis well behind us by dilution of good activities. I hope I left you some time. I'd never looked at my watch once, but that's about what I wanted to say. Thank you. We'll turn it over to Mr. Jackson because I'm sure that his ears perked up when I pointed out that much of this activity was the result of our using Dixon Eaton and public relations.
I want to make essentially two points. Hopefully you won't, hopefully no one again ever will have a Kent State kind of a problem. But in our experience in working with a number of campuses in the United States and Canada, and also with a number of other kinds of institutions, and maybe I should say that's one of the points I want to make, is that if those of us who work in higher education want to solve our problems, I do believe firmly we have to stop thinking of ourselves as somehow different or unique. It is no different whatsoever. The public doesn't make any differentiation between you or General Motors or the federal government or the local school board or the local hospital. I'm sorry I even have to say that, but I do run into it every day. Well, of course, I'm in higher education. It's different here. It isn't different. But that's not one of the two points I want to make. The first point I want to make is that the word crisis has been so overused, I think we had better define it, and I would suggest to each of you that you define what a crisis is for your campus, and I'll talk about that a little bit. The second point I want to make, and maybe this relates to the overuse of the word, is that most crises, I personally, from our firm's experience, estimate about 90% of the crises that occur are self-generated. Either we see them coming and don't do anything about them, or we take a relatively minor incident, and by our own response, we make it into a major crisis. Let me see if I can define a crisis in a way that will talk to what might happen on your specific campuses. There are seven elements in a crisis. The first is a crisis should be a turning point. It's got to be significant enough that it indicates some kind of a turning point in the institution, in the institution's relations with some group, in some program of the institution, perhaps if you're a state university, perhaps in the legislature's view of your institution. It's got to be a turning point. Secondly, it should be potentially damaging. Well, obviously, it isn't a crisis unless it's going to do some damage to you. Thirdly, a true crisis involves struggle and conflict. There are opposing views and opposing forces. Fourthly, a crisis is inevitably surrounded with a sense of dread and anxiety. It may be on the institution's side, and it may just be dread and anxiety that is motivating those who are, in essence, opposing or questioning the institution at that moment. Fifthly, there is this adversarial atmosphere. There can, after all, be issues that are discussed quite rationally that could include these other elements, but this adversarial nature is what truly makes a crisis for an institution. You know, if you can all go to lunch and talk about it, it isn't really a crisis. You can make it into one very easily, but it isn't at that moment a crisis. Finally, there are, therefore, as a result of all this, truly opposing forces that you can identify. In short, a true crisis is bad news for your organization, and you cannot just ignore it. However, that doesn't mean you should overtly do anything about it, and I'll come back to that point in a minute. I think it is important to differentiate a crisis, which has these characteristics that I've described, from a typical issue, which is being debated, which probably has some rational views on both sides, and is merely a typical discussion in a democratic fashion to arrive at a change or a policy or whatever it is that is under discussion. But a crisis has one other element, and that is it usually involves surprise. That's what differentiates it from an issue most of the time. It's something that catches us unaware. Now, when you have a crisis of that kind, there are generally three questions that are asked by your public. The first is, what happened? Or what is happening? The second is, why didn't you warn us about this? Why didn't you tell us sooner? It was a surprise to you, of course, but people want to know, why didn't you tell us about this sooner? And thirdly, they want to know, why didn't you prevent it? Now, just knowing those three questions empowers us as practitioners to begin dealing with the surprise crisis. That list, by the way, comes from a gleaning of not only a number of case studies, but also a lot of psychological research that has been done on individuals responding to surprise situations. And so I think it's a fairly trustworthy list. The question before us this morning is whether or not there are any new ways of dealing with these situations. Probably most of the ideas have indeed been around for a while. And yet I think we can rightfully call them new because many of us as practitioners, and certainly many of our institutions, have never employed these ideas to deal with crisis. I can identify four new ideas, using new again in quotes in this definition I've just given. The first is to evaluate the situation before we act. What we call in our practice attempting to manage the perceptions that are going to be out there around this issue. Now this is new because the typical response, particularly in higher education where most of our administrators have very little training in management, particularly our chief administrators, if you're in a public institution, your board of governors or trustees is not chosen to sit there because they are experts at administration or management or dealing with publics. They're there for other reasons. I'm not criticizing them. This is just factual. If you're sitting there thinking that your president is indeed an excellent executive with training in management, I would like to see your data to indicate that. We just know this isn't true. Given that kind of a situation, higher education is terribly vulnerable. Because the first response of our people is, we got to respond to this. We got to get the word out. That's wrong. Let's get the facts out there. And the new way to deal with this that I can stand behind because we've used it so many times is instead to evaluate very carefully before we act and attempt to manage the perceptions that are going to result from whatever action we take. And the first question is, should we respond at all? Will response deal with the issue or turn it into a crisis? If we should respond, to whom? To whom? To the perpetrators of the crisis? If a legislative committee has said, your state university is wasting a lot of dollars, perhaps the one and only place that we ought to respond is directly back to the perpetrators of the situation, to the legislative committee, as one example. Secondly, should we respond to the stakeholder publics, to those people that truly have an interest in whatever the crisis is, but not to a lot of other people who frankly have no interest and are merely going to view it as the wonderfully entertaining passing parade in which other folks are being pilloried? Should we talk only to our internal public? Probably our most important publics of all. Or do we have to go truly public, including the news media? Now, implied in all of this is a tenet of faith that I think all public relations professionals have to adopt in the modern era, and that is no one elected the news media to represent the public. It's just a factual situation that I think we have to be more cognizant of. In the present media business, the First Amendment, Thomas Jefferson, reportorial responsibilities of the media rank so far second to the profit-making, entertainment attributes of the media that if we're going to be realistic about our jobs, we have to remember that the media have a place, a very important place in our society, but that we should use them in that place and not somehow feel that they are the judge and jury and that everything that happens, we immediately run to the news media and say, here it is, we're reporting in, gang. That's not the way it works in our experience. So first, a new idea is try evaluating before you act. See if you can manage the perceptions of what's going to result. And of course, that implies some counseling skills on your part to get your administration to cool it while you try to deal with the situation professionally. The second new idea is to see if we can evaluate the crisis before it occurs. In other words, to anticipate the issues which might become crises. issues anticipation has to be the single greatest contribution any public relations professional can make to any institution. Because clearly, if we can foresee what's likely to occur, we can save time, relationships, build morale, and so forth. If we can do this, however, we must be able to know exactly what a crisis may be for our institution, not some laundry list of types of crisis, but what truly would be a crisis on your campus. And some of the things may be really unthought of unless you go into this with some real planning skills. Declining enrollment, sure, that may be a crisis. Bob referred to the dormitory situation. Empty dormitories could be a big crisis. Overfilled dormitories may be a major crisis for you, and yet peripheral issues to the central thrust of your institution. But make a list of what is a crisis for your institution. Every futurist that I have ever heard or read lists that as number one. Make an actual list for your place. Secondly, from that list, plan which of these types of crises will probably demand that you act, and which of these kinds of crises will beg you to play down, to cool, not to respond to. And you can, I've made many of these lists, you can with some accuracy make that prediction. For example, an enrollment decline is one that you can probably play down. A sports scandal, forget it. I mean, that's public. The stakeholder public there is the great general. Joe and Jane Sixpack are involved in that one. They read the sports pages. You might as well start right off going public, because that's where it is. Then, having done that, make scenarios, which is a lot of fun. If you've never done scenarios, once you've got your list of crises, make an actual scenario. Write a little short story. You know, this happened. This is who did it. This is how we responded. This is a result. Just write out scenarios with all of the variables in them. And you are, in fact, using a great theatrical technique to pre-enact what is going to happen. My third suggestion is that when you have a crisis and you really are caught in it, follow the rule of drowning bad news. If you've got one that you have to go public with, I guess we all know now that you go public fast, complete, so that it's done, it's over. You don't leave any follow-up stories. You kill it the first time. And if it's a kind of crisis, since a true crisis involves an adversarial situation, you probably don't respond too much to the other side, because, of course, that just keeps it in the public eye. If then, having done that, one can do the kind of thing which essentially Kent State did, only over a longer period of time, and concentrate on getting out the good stuff. You can drown the bad news pretty fast, particularly if you aim at targeted audiences and you aim at those that are most important to you, existing students, existing alums, potential students. You know who they are. You know who your important audiences are. But if you can drown the bad news directly to them, that works very well. It's sort of a corollary of the principle of not responding to a rumor, but blanketing a rumor. Simply blanket the rumor. If you respond to a rumor, it's the same as responding to a crisis. You yourself verify the situation. You prove the accuracy of that situation. Even if it's inaccurate, your response psychologically indicates that there's something there. And so the basic rule on a rumor is not at all to deal with the rumor, but to find some way of just blanketing the rumor without ever saying it ain't so, to show by an action that it isn't so. Let me give you an example. A bakery in the East has been having a lot of trouble because the word somehow got out that they were owned by the Moonies. Okay? Now, they had two choices of what they might do. They were advised by one group to simply do a big campaign saying, "We're not owned by the Moonies." Well, of course, my evaluation of that was that after they finished that, everybody would think they were owned by the Moonies. I mean, it's just basic communications theory. So instead, what was proposed as an alternative was that they have a big campaign showing the conglomerate that actually did own them in some kind of an activity between the conglomerate's management and their management. So the key thing was X bakery, subsidiary of Y conglomerate, does Z. It just blanketed the rumor without ever even dealing with the fact that anybody had said they were owned by the Moonies. That rule, in a similar fashion, is how one drowns bad news. And believe me, it is possible. Finally, if you have a crisis as a public relations professional in your institution, please do not go around asking anybody for sympathy. Instead, go around saying, "Hallelujah, at last, everybody in this joint is going to have to pay attention to me to know what I can do, and I am going to use this to prove the skills, the techniques that are available in modern day professional public relations in order to get acceptance and understanding of this skill in the administration and on this campus. Because if you can do that, maybe we can really do something about the problems of higher education. And if you'd like somebody to pick it or set up some crises for you, just call me. We represent a lot of movement groups, and I can probably set something up. A few general rules before we share everybody's thoughts on this. Remember that it is emotion, not facts, that you are to deal with. So for heaven's sakes, diffuse the emotions by not lashing back at the source of the crisis. Because that's an emotional kind of a response. And if you have had a crisis, that means you've got emotion involved. And if we lash back, that's emotional. Now we've got two emotional groups fighting with one another, and the public all pulls up their seats very close because they want a ringside view of the struggle. So remember, facts have very little to do with it. There are sort of five rules, I think, that most professionals follow for managing confrontations of this kind. The first is stick to the issue. Don't drag in others. That rule is violated so often, and yet if we just stick to the issue at hand. Secondly, be able to admit you're wrong. That is often the best way to diffuse a crisis. Just say, "Hey, we screwed up. You know, we goofed. We're human over here. This proves it. And we're sorry. We'll try to be less human in the future," or whatever your response is. Thirdly, don't scapegoat or fault find. Oh my goodness, how often we read, it's like the most famous story I can tell you about that is the Hooker Chemical Company, which in truth is totally factually courtroom innocent of Love Canal, and yet when they finally got a chance to go on national television, they didn't send their public relations vice president, they sent their lawyer, and when the cameras focused on him, the first words out of his mouth were, "It isn't our fault," and the public said, "You SOB," when he could have said something else that would not have been fault-finding. He could have said, for example, "We had nothing to do with this, but we feel terrible. People have lost their homes." The public would have said, "Gee, you know, that's a caring company." So don't fault-find or scapegoat. Fourthly, counteract misinformation, but don't counteract its source. Don't go after the persons who handed out the information. That's emotional again. You're really leaving yourself wide open. Finally, and oh, this is so important, and it's so human nature in all of us to violate this rule, never ridicule. You can be 99% of the way through a crisis, ridicule the opposition once, and turn that thing completely around and have to start over. And I'm sorry to say I've been there a couple of times. Second general rule, the facts of bad news are not nearly as important as the message they may imply. And think about that for a minute. It's the overriding perception that goes with the fact that is more important than the specific fact. It's like Johnny can't read, right, in the secondary schools. And what does everybody think? The schools are terrible because somebody did a study that seems to show Johnny can't read. The public has a lovely way of making things bigger. In short, be careful not to add implications. Thirdly, most important of all, internal audiences are far more critical in a crisis situation than any other. If you have limited time, and you've got a really bad situation, but you can only do so much, and you had to make the choice, choose to talk to your own gang, to your internal audiences. Let the public rant and rave if you had to make the choice. talk to your gang. See if you can hang on to some morale through it all, if you can keep teamwork going, and most importantly, keep them all informed so everybody speaks with one clear voice. Remember, every janitor, student, other person on campus, as far as the public is concerned, is a CIA agent inside your place. Because if I live next door to a janitor and something's going on at your institution, I go over to him and I say, "Joe, what's really going on over there?" And Joe says, "Let me tell you." Now, when Joe says, "Let me tell you," I, for one, want Joe telling what really is happening in a positive sense, in one clear voice fashion from the institution. Finally, in this question of talking to internal audiences, never forget the recent rash of studies that indicate that despite everything we do, that students are still the number one information source about higher education in this country. We recently did a study on a major state university campus that had been browbeaten by the media for about 10 years, and we found that by a factor of 8 to 1, the people in that state learned about the institution from students as opposed to news media. And so the institution had been wasting its time talking to the media when they should have been talking to their own students about getting the word out. Well, there's a lot more that could be said about this topic. I think, however, I would like to leave you with just one thought. Arthur Page is really one of the founders of public relations in the United States. He built the department at American Telephone and Telegraph in the very early years of this century. And at the end of his career, he said something that, to me, tells why planning, trying to anticipate issues, is really the only way, successfully, to deal with most crises. Page said, "Whenever the public has an idea that they would like to change an institution and make it perform in a certain way, the public convicts the institution of not having performed that way before it was told." Note that, before it was told. The only safeguard for those of us in an institution, therefore, is to keep a pretty careful watch on the way people's minds are running. Figure out the coming public attitudes, what the public decisions are likely to be, and then be ready for them. We must try not to be in the position of being convicted of treason. We must obey the rules even before they are passed. He said that in about 1923. I think all of us know that Arthur Page was absolutely right. And so the only new way to deal with a crisis that Page didn't have available to him, it seems to me, is to apply what we've learned in these years about public relations and to really have some issues anticipation on our campuses. Now, I guess many of you have responses to what Bob and I have said. And Martha, you want to run that end of it?
We only have time for about 3 comments. So let's start.
I'd like to ask Mr. Jackson, doesn't you think by not contacting the media initially that you may create skepticism in their part? In other words, make it seem like a crisis by not contacting them?
Certainly you have to make that evaluation. Here's what we're finding more and more. First of all, the media are interested in an issue like this if it is truly going to be a controversy, or if they have been taking a specific position and then they can cover this story and say, "We told you so. You know, we've been kind of warning you about Siwash all along, and now here's some data." And, you know, I hope nobody's sitting there thinking, "Gosh, journalists wouldn't do that." Because, I mean, if you can find me such a journalist, I really would like to get that person. I know some places I'd like to get them hired. I think it's a risk, but I think it's a lot smaller risk than it used to be. How many of you, for example, are finding that the number of journalists covering higher education or the number of reporters on newspapers covering universities have been increasing in staff size? You have. Well, you're very rare. Most?
Only recently.
Only recently. All right, you're really very rare on a national basis. Staffs are being cut in most cases. They're putting that money into ad salesmen. You know, when Katie Graham at the Washington Post, when she every year balances her account on Wall Street to look good there by whacking the editorial budget of the Post, I think that gives us a rather good indication. So sure, you know, I'm a little blithe about dealing with the media, but I have found that most of our problems with the media we make, we run to them with stuff that they probably, you know, well, let me ask you this. Do you have any trouble getting them to consider good stuff from you? You bet you do. Well, it's easy for us to say, oh, they're only interested in the bad news. If I bring them something bad, they'll cover it. And that's, there's some truth in that. But basically, you have to interest them these days in almost anything, unless it's such an obvious crisis, and in that case, it would be a public one, and you'd probably be going with it anyway.
Say you're in a situation where you have one group that is trying to get your legislature to change something that you want to continue doing.
Right.
Well, you go to, I assume from what you're saying, you would go to legislature, but they have the power to stop the movement. But what about that very vocal, very emotional group that is stirring everything up?
Well, you see, you have to ask yourself the question of whether you can convert the opposition. And that depends on which of three categories the opposition falls into. There are what we call, you know, specific againers. I mean, they're again a specific thing, and they really feel about that, and they've probably got some data. But because they are against a specific thing, they're probably pretty rational, too, and you can talk to them. Certainly go to them. But then there are perpetual againers. They're just sort of again everything because it beats watching television. You know, it's more fun to sign up for causes. And even that group you can probably talk to. That group you can best deal with by showing that you've got more horses than they have, and they're going to lose. And then they'll usually find another cause because it's more fun to be with a winner. And then there's that third group, the zealots. Well, you know, forget them. I mean, there's just nothing you can do with zealots. So depending on which group these other people fall into, I'd either go to them, try and overwhelm them, or ignore them. But the thing with legislative issues is, I recently went through one where some group went to the legislature. They thought it was unfair that we had sabbaticals. As a practitioner, I've always thought that was quite unfair myself, but I didn't side with them, because, I mean, I don't get one. What should we have done? Some folks said, we'll go public with this. We'll say, teachers deserve sabbaticals. Well, there's a winner, isn't it? Every steel worker would love to hear that. Teachers deserve sabbaticals. So finally, we were able to convince the administration that, let's not do that. Let's just talk to the legislature, fight it out in the halls, and if it leaks out, we'll have to deal with it. Then we will have to somehow justify it. But for heaven's sakes, don't make a crisis of something that you can't justify, unless you have a very enlightened administration that is, you know, trying to do away with tenure and sabbaticals or something like that.
What about professional affairs?
Beg pardon?
You're up against another PR company.
Well, you better have some pretty good help on your side, and you better, you know, it's funny though, when you're up against professionals, one of the things you might even want to think about is talking to your fellow professionals, particularly if you are members of a similar professional organization or whatever. The lawyers all talk, you know. Wes Christensen and I have been on opposite sides of issues, and we talk. As a matter of fact, it's usually helpful to both of you. You can at least agree on the facts the way the lawyers do in depositions. You know, the funny thing about that is when each side has professional counsel is that that's what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in 1776 were all talking about, wasn't it? That we would all throw the ideas out in the court of public opinion and the court of public opinion would make the decision. So the biggest job there when you're really up against opposition that is as well advised as you are is to prepare your management for the fact that this is how the democratic society works and we may lose. We may be the ones that have to make a change. It's not easy, I know, but
thank you all.